Watcher, and it's that time again. It's the real enjoyment of jazz with me, Mike Wynn. Trombonist and occasionally French hornist Roswell Rudd died a week or so ago. And here he is leading his own quartet. And typical of Rudd, one of the quartet is a singer.
That's what you should be doing. Do whatever turns you on, baby. That's what we'll do for you. We can't begin to get to you until you do what turns you on. Whatever turns you on, baby. That's what you should be doing. Whatever turns you on, baby, that's what we'll do for you. We can't begin to get to you until you do what turns you on. Now you gotta do what you gotta do. When you gotta do what you gotta do, you better do what you gotta do. When you gotta do what you gotta do, 'cause you know we can't begin to get to you until you do what turns you on. So you know you gotta do it.
Thank you.
the recently departed Roswell Rudd. Here he is, trombonist and leader on this 2008 Soundscape album. Rudd often described himself as a frustrated singer, but here he wisely lets the gloriously named Sonny Kim take over the singing. Lafayette Harris piano, Bradley Jones bass. And that's it, a quartet. Roswell always enjoyed the avant-garde end of the spectrum, although in his later years he embraced all types of jazz. He and I had a long-running, if sporadic, email relationship. You know the sort. Have you heard this? Yes, I have. Liked it. He died last month, aged 82. And yes, I know we played Art Pepper just last week, but please listen to this blistering solo. Thank you. Tokyo, April 77, and Art Pepper, as a convicted drug addict, wasn't allowed into Japan, but by quietly making him a guest, a very prominent guest, of the Calcedo Sextet, he, Art, came on stage after the intermission of their first concert to rapturous applause. And it was indeed rapturous. Japanese audiences can often be restrained. But on this occasion, the applause was long and certainly heartfelt. Art Pepper later described the reception in his fabulous book Straight Life as, quote, "the most beautiful feeling in my life. It justified my whole existence, my whole past, my whole life," unquote. And he simply launched into Cherokee. We only had time for the first half. Claire Fisher, keyboards, totally unrelated. Rob Fisher, bass. Peter Rizzo, drums. Pancho Sanchez, percussion. And no Calcedo on that particular song. Here's another version of the old traditional song, Danny Boy. Yes, of course, Danny Boy. That was recorded June 2014 in New York. Peter Leach, guitar and leader, Ray Drummond, bass, and Steve Johns, drums. And I don't need to tell you any more. This next group is, I think, rather cleverly called a small tet. Thank you. interesting, a mix of styles. Arranger George Russell was the non-playing captain on this December 56 recording session for RCA Records, and all the songs were George Russell compos. I say he was a non-playing captain. He did, in fact, on other tracks, play the boom bams, chromatically tuned drums, with variously length tubes with membranes stretched over one end. Hence, the boom bams are a member of the membranophone family. So now we know. We heard the Sad Sergeant, Hal McCusick, flute, Art Farmer, trumpet, Bill Evans, no less, on piano, Teddy Kotick, bass, Barry Galbraith, guitar, Ozzy Johnson, drums. And it must be time for a piano solo. And that was Lisa Hilton, one of our faves of the current crop, with one of her own songs, Blue Reflections, recorded on a Hamburg Steinway D in New York, January 2010. This next one will most certainly be a contrast. It's called Ghost of Congo Square. Thank you. This Blue Note album, recorded 2007 in LA mainly, a couple of the songs being recorded elsewhere. It's under the leadership of trumpeter Terence Blanchard, who was born and raised in New Orleans. The album is entitled A Tale of God's Will and subtitled A Requiem for Katrina. That's obviously Hurricane Katrina. That so devastated New Orleans and the surrounding area in late August 2006. This album tells the tragic story with titles including Levee's Wading Through, A Time of Need, The Water, Ghost of 1927, Funeral Dirge. But I chose the opening track, which tells of life before Katrina, Ghost of Congo Square. Congo Square being where the then slaves would meet in New Orleans to sing and dance to African songs. It's also where the authorities would display the severed heads of those who revolted against slavery. New Orleans has seen more than its fair share of grief and tragedy and cruelty. Terence Blanchard on trumpet, as we know, Bryce Winston tenor, Aaron Parks piano, Derek Hodge bass, Kendrick Scott drums, and Zach Harmon tabla and the Happy Apple. Next, Gladys. Recorded in Holland, Monster Holland, in May 85, two of Holland's best musos, Rinder Graf piano and Koos Seriese bass. That song, written by Lionel Hampton, was called Gladys, a wonderfully old-fashioned name these days, it seems nowadays, to suit that of a 94-year-old biscuit-eating seamstress or similar. But here, on this occasion, it's the very formidable Mrs. Gladys Hampton, who managed Hamp, and therefore his band, with the proverbial rod of iron. It was a brave and indeed short-lived band member who crossed this Gladys. Crackly old LP, though. We'd better have a dollop of the organ. Thank you. And that's from an original pressing Argo LP called Please, Mr. Organ Player, he being Milt Buckner, recorded in Chicago, May 1960. I chose, for the second week running, Nat Adderley's Sermonette. Hope that was okay. Milt Buckner on the Hammond B3, inevitably. James Campbell, alto. Reggie Boyd, guitar. Richard Evans, bass. Maurice Sinclair, drums. Next, I'm playing you just an extract of a spoken word LP that I heard for the very first time this morning. It has a jazz background, which is why I bought it. But it's the unbelievably harrowing story that grabs the attention totally. It's called A Night at Santa Rita, a prison farm in Santa Barbara County. I must warn you, the narration does include some profanities.
The National Guard had simply closed off a large area of downtown Berkeley, arresting shoppers and protesters alike. I had a valid press pass, given to me that day by the Berkeley police. But with my long hair and all, Sergeant Number One would not let me leave the ring. Angry, I sat down with those caught, chatting for hours, surrounded by bayonets. A cop pulled me out and said I was arrested. I showed him my press card. Terribly impressed, he used it to get my name and address and sent me on to fingerprinting and the sheriff's bus. Like the others, I expected to be bailed out after a few hours booking at Santa Rita, the county prison farm, and then be home for a late dinner. Like the others, I was to be in a state of literal terror for the next 16 hours. The one-inch slit in the window of the Alameda County Sheriff's bus didn't let us see much of Santa Rita Rehabilitation Center, low white barracks. Somebody jokingly referred to it as a cross between a concentration camp and a chicken farm. The bus stopped at the gates, and two guards with shotguns jumped on. All right, you creeps, move your asses out of here. The last guy out gets his head cracked open. People who live in college towns spend their lives seeing old gangster movies, and it was difficult at first to realize that corn and violence had suddenly become the real world. We stumbled out of the bus and through a gauntlet of club-swinging deputy sheriffs. The guy in front faltered, and they hit him on the head. It does sound like a crack. He said something like, "Take it easy," and they moved in on him. The rest of us made it through the gate and were greeted by the sight of 200 arrestees lying prone on a concrete yard, heads turned sideways, hands straight back at their sides, legs pulled close together. 200 bodies perfectly tense and quiet. But the guards walking between the rows of bodies gave proof of life as they whacked and poked the men with their clubs. These guards were the same deputies who had done all the shooting in Berkeley the week before, the Blue Meanies. In America, it's always comic book death. macabre, unreal, and later funny. It was getting dark and cold. The countryside was moorish and vacant. We could hear no cars moving on Highway 50 below. And the place was flooded with guards, enough to turn any organized resistance into a bloodbath. The concrete was gravelly, and it dug into your cheek. The wind blew some of the smaller bits into your eyes, which had to be opened to catch sight of the guard about to whack your limbs for having moved or shivered in the bitter cold. After 30 minutes, you could turn your head to rest on the other cheek. We lay there from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. The fellow who was beaten as we came off the bus was forced to take a different position, resting on his knees, arms hanging at his sides, while three guards systematically beat him for several minutes. One guard for the stomach, one for the back, and one who specialized on the head. When he got out later, a doctor reported that he pissed blood and that his body was a mass of bruises. The rest of us just lay there. No one said anything. No one protested. Perhaps some tried to, but the minute their hands moved, they became the center of other guards' attention. If you don't like it, do something, and we'll bust you on a felony for assaulting an officer. You'll never get out. That's the threat that finally keeps you in line. While my body had suddenly become very important because it was vulnerable to pain, my mind floated elsewhere, giddy and irrelevant. All this time, I thought of James Reston and Max Lerner and the other good, rational men. I began to compose an open letter to Reston. "Dear Scotty," it went, "this letter concerns your column holding the new left responsible for the increase of violence in American society. You condemn the new left for its distrust of the legal system. Remember? It's the column that had the cute line about the new left kids being neo-Nazi crybabies who won't pay their dues. Well, before I get into those arguments, Scotty, why don't you try paying some dues? Lie down on this concrete floor, motherfucker. Hands back, legs together, as the guards here say. Come on, creep faggot, get your ass down there. Cheek to the stone, keep your hands out. What are you doing, masturbating? Move your head and I crack it open. At Santa Rita, we shoot to kill. Sorry, Scotty. Have to run now. There's this guard talking to me."
Oh! And it goes on in that vein. If anything, it gets worse, if that's possible. Most of us who listen to this programme live in the first world, and we tend to criticise other nations for their lack of civil rights, and yet we have no right to do that whatsoever. Events like this happened, or still happen, as though it's just part of everyday life, and the system, the state, allows these things to happen to innocent people protesting or even reporting on a protest. Can you imagine how terrifying this must have been for these innocent people? Some, of course, may still be incarcerated for all we know. After that story, it's relatively academic to tell you that Roscoe narrated, James Spaulding was on flute, Ron Carter bass. It's a Flying Dutchman gatefold LP. Somehow, try to hear it all. It's life-changing. Somehow, Mary Lou Williams will follow that. Thank you. the legendary pianist Mary Lou Williams with the Gershwin Brothers, They Can't Take That Away From Me, recorded in London, Jan 53 with local boys, Ken Napper bass and Alan Ganley drums. Mary Lou was in the UK for several months and made two other recordings with local musos. It was her first trip away from New York as a solo artist, and she proved enormously popular. So she was back the following year, 54, in both London and Paris. As I'm sure you know, Mary Lou Williams spent some time helping Duke Ellington with arrangements for the band. Here is the Duke, but in keeping with this week's spoken word theme, here's a small part of an Ellington interview in 1962.
1934 was a good year for you with Solitude, too.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. That came out in 35, I think. It was, yeah. Solitude, yeah. I wrote that in 20 minutes, standing up.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's another one of those things. Somebody was in the... We were in Chicago in the Victor studio, and someone else was late getting out of the recording studio, and I needed to pull, leaning up one of those against one of those glass and office enclosures, you know, and I wrote it out, the whole, what orchestration there was of it.
20 minutes to write a song. I never talk money with people that we interview over the years here in the program. What does that 20 minutes mean to you per year? Would you mind telling me, or is that a big secret now? As far as royalties.
Jack, I really haven't the slightest idea.
It's healthy.
I've told you in one way, and I'll tell you, they never let me look at these things. They don't want me to lose my drive, you know. They don't want to stunt my talent.
I have two favorite Ellington compositions. This is one of them, in a sentimental mood, and there is a beautiful melody.
That was written very spontaneously. One playing, swoop, just like that. And the occasion... I was in Durham, South Carolina, and after this dance, we went up to the North Carolina Mutual building, an insurance building. Some friends of mine were the executives up there, and we had a party, a lot of ladies and gentlemen, and we were having a bit of sipping, and it was a rather gay party, with the exception of two girls and one fella. And it seems that they were all friends of mine. One girl had been engaged to this young man for a long time, and suddenly her best friend was now, you know, going to take her away from him. And so I had the two chicks, one on each side of me, and I says, now just listen to this. I'm going to, you know, listen to this and get there. You girls are too good of friends to let anything like this come between you. And this is what I played for him, and I played it, and I remembered it, and then I put it down.
The lyric came how long again here after the song?
I don't remember when it was, a year or possibly later.
Strange. You know, there's some of the vocalists that haven't been mentioned up to this time. There was a... we mentioned him earlier, Sonny Greer. We have him singing...
An LP-length interview, some 50 minutes worth, with Jack Cullen in Vancouver, October 62, for a local radio station. As we know well, the Duke could embellish facts and tell his version of events, but quite possibly he did write Solitude in 20 minutes, leaning against a glass partition. And here's a second song by Roswell Rudd. It's from his first record as a leader, March 74, and it's a perfect example of Rudd's early avant-garde style. It may not quite be ours, but it's interesting. Let's hope you agree.
Only one request. you'll spend it with me. Of your days, all the nickels and the dimes of your days, let the reason and the rhymes of your days begin and end with me.
No, not my fave record of all time, but I felt that the recently departed trombonist Roswell Rudd deserved a couple of songs this week, even if it stretched our normal playlist, What Are You Doing for the Rest of Your Life?, which was the most straight ahead of the songs on this Arista LP, if you can imagine that. Sheila Jordan was the singer, Hod O'Brien piano, the Norwegian Harold Anderson on bass, and Barry Atchell drums. So farewell, Roswell Rudd. And it's time for our last one, I'm afraid, and I've chosen an LP that was recorded in Barnes, London, it says here, March 76. It's the Tony Lee Trio, Lee Piano, Tony Archer Bass and Martin Drew Drums, and it's a real antidote to that last free jazz song, Once in a While. Oddly for this very British LP, with excellent liner notes by Humphrey Littleton, it's on a Japanese record label. Thank you. As ever, I really hope you've enjoyed this week's selections. Perhaps even more variety than our norm, spoken word and avant-garde. Equally hope you'll be back with me, Mike Wynn, for next week's The Real Enjoyment of Jazz. Until then, please take care. Be well.